The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the September 30th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump stumbles back into the birther issue. What happened? As polls showed the presidential race drawing almost even, Donald Trump drew attention away from his faltering Democratic opponent by reigniting the birther controversy last week. At an event largely dedicated to showing off his new hotel in Washington, D.C., the Republican nominee acknowledged for the first time that President Obama was born in the U.S. and blamed Hillary Clinton for launching the unfounded rumors that Obama wasn't a natural-born citizen. Trump also insisted he had resolved the issue by pressuring the president into releasing his birth certificate in 2011. Hillary Clinton and her campaign of 2008 started the birther controversy, he said. I finished it. Clinton's aide said a single unpaid volunteer forwarded a birther email in 2008 and was promptly fired, and neither Clinton herself nor her campaign ever suggested Obama was born abroad. Clinton called on Trump to apologize to the president. Trump's campaign was founded on this outrageous lie, she said. There is no erasing it in history. Trump also stirred controversy by suggesting that Clinton's Secret Service detail should stop carrying guns in order to show her the importance of Second Amendment rights. Let's see what happens to her, he said. It'll be very dangerous. His son, Donald Jr., later came under fire for repeating several themes from white nativist websites, including a tweet likening Syrian refugees to poisoned candy. If I had a bowl of Skittles and I told you just three would kill you, read the tweet, would you take a handful? In the RealClearPolitics.com national poll average, Clinton's head-to-head lead over Trump fell to just 1 point, 45-44, down from 6 points at the end of August. Polls also showed Trump leading or tying Clinton in the battleground states of Ohio, Florida, and Iowa. 538.com's election forecast puts the Republican nominee's chance of winning the election at 43.2%, up from 26.2% at the start of September. What the editorial said. Trump deserves about as much credit for this ridiculously belated admission as he should get for declaring that the earth is round, said the USA Today. The only reason he backed down was to convince moderate Republicans that he's not a racist. His crackpot theory not only undermined the legitimacy of our country's first black president, it also breathed life into a radical bigoted fringe in America, who are now Trump's most ardent supporters. Birtherism was Trump's big lie, said the Washington Post, and it's too late for him to undo the damage. Thanks to Trump's dogged perpetuation of this monumental falsehood, a recent poll found that 67% of Republicans still say Obama was not born in the U.S., or that they're not sure where he was born. Trump's claim that it was Clinton who started the birther movement is arguably his most brazen lie yet, said the New York Daily News. It was Trump alone who lifted birtherism from its internet's fever swamps to the mainstream. And only a sociopath would then try to shift blame for his own reprehensible actions to his opponent. Even after Obama released his long-form birth certificate in 2011, Trump repeatedly insisted that an extremely credible source told him the certificate was a fraud. When asked earlier this year where Obama was born, Trump responded, "Who knows?" What the columnist said. Trump will always be a birther, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. Attacking Obama as a secret Muslim born in Kenya was the catapult that launched him into conservative fame, which culminated in his winning the Republican nomination. Trump's belief that non-white Americans are inherently suspicious is the core of his political identity, the position that gives coherence to his attacks on Mexican and Muslim immigrants. For African Americans, Trump's birtherism is more than an unsavory campaign tactic, said Isaac Bailey in Politico.com. It's a personal affront, proof that no matter how much we achieve, we are foreigners in our own country, vulnerable to unfounded accusations, forever having to get the approval of white men. Trump's campaign aides must be tearing their hair out, said Eliana Johnson in NationalReview.com. After a terrible week for Clinton, in which she denounced half of Trump's supporters as deplorables and got caught lying about her pneumonia, her poll lead nearly vanished, and people were starting to believe Trump could win. By putting an old, damaging issue front and center, he has squandered that momentum. The old Trump has returned. Despite Trump's poll gains, Clinton remains in the driver's seat, said Chris Salisa in WashingtonPost.com. The electoral map strongly favors Democrats, and unless Trump can win Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and several other swing states, Clinton is still on course to secure the 270 Electoral College votes she needs to win. Don't be so sure, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Trump essentially wiped out Clinton's lead by acting like a somewhat normal presidential candidate for 2 weeks. Clinton is widely loathed and distrusted, as well as being a boring, plodding campaigner. Democrats are right to be panicking because if Trump can manage to act like an acceptable leader for the next 5 weeks, the biggest black swan event in American electoral history just might happen. And a second main story, terrorist suspect caught after bombings. What happened? The man charged with setting off bombs in New York City and New Jersey wrote in a journal that he was inspired by Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders and hoped to kill non-believers, prosecutors said this week. Ahmad Khan Romani, a 28-year-old naturalized U.S. citizen from Afghanistan, began his terrorism spree in Seaside Park, New Jersey last week when a pipe bomb exploded in a trash can along the route of a Marine Corps charity race. 11 hours later, a bomb packed with shrapnel blew apart a dumpster in Manhattan's bustling Chelsea neighborhood, injuring 31 people. 4 blocks away, police safely removed a pressure cooker bomb rigged to a cell phone. Later, more devices were discovered at the train station in Rahami's hometown of Elizabeth, New Jersey. The suspect was arrested after he was shot and wounded in a gunfight with police in Linden, New Jersey. Friends said Rahami, who came to the U.S. at age 7, had become markedly more religious in recent years after visiting Afghanistan and Pakistan. The bombings came the same day a Kenyan-born ethnic Somali security guard stabbed and wounded 9 people in a St. Cloud, Minnesota shopping mall. Shot dead by an off-duty police officer, Dahir Adan, 22, was proclaimed a soldier of ISIS by a propaganda outfit linked to the group. The attacks immediately became part of the presidential campaign. Republican Donald Trump called for the profiling of Muslims. They're trying to be politically correct in our country, and this is only going to get worse. While Democrat Hillary Clinton said her opponent's rhetoric played into the hands of jihadists seeking a religious conflict. What the editorial said. Clinton acted like leader. Trump did not, said the Washington Post. Before authorities had even figured out the cause of the Chelsea explosion, the Republican proclaimed at a rally in Colorado that a bomb had gone off. He may have guessed right, but that would be a reckless way to do business in the Oval Office. By contrast, Clinton wanted to know the facts and called for the support of first responders and the injured. It was the kind of calm and caution one naturally expects from a leader. It's long past time for a coherent, coordinated, aggressive strategy to prevent jihadist attacks, said NationalReview.com. We should start by tightening our immigration laws and getting rid of inane edicts, such as the years-long ban on reviewing the social media accounts of would-be immigrants. Those seeking entry to the U.S. should face serious scrutiny. It's not xenophobic to prefer applicants who embrace American ideals. What the columnist said. These attacks don't prove that immigrants are terrorist threats, said Zach Beauchamp in Vox.com. For one thing, Rahami came to the U.S. as a child, so he is radicalized after he became an American. That fits the profile of the typical ISIS domestic supporter. Most are U.S.-born or have lived here a long time. The average American has only 1 in 3.6 million chance of being killed in terrorist attacks involving an immigrant in any given year. You are more likely to get hit by a train. There are a couple of important lessons we can take from last week's bombings and stabbings, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. Firstly, it's clear that there is a benefit to allowing competent and responsible adults to carry guns, like the off-duty officer who shot the jihadist in Minnesota. Another is that surveillance can help keep us safe. A black-and-white image of Rahami near the Chelsea bomb site caught by one of the New York City's 8,000 cameras helped identify him as the culprit. These are lessons the political left doesn't want to hear because they're so convinced that guns can only cause violence, not stop it, and that security is the antithesis of, not the precondition to, civil liberty. Let's not act like we're under siege, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. The clumsy bombing and misfire and the speedy apprehension of the suspect shows that the actual threat from terrorism is low, very low. But our psyches are so scarred by 9/11 that even botched attempts by lone wolf losers feel like a dire assault on the homeland, with media and the likes of Trump happily fanning the flames. Perhaps the next generation with no memory of 9/11 can guide us out of our paranoia. Our controversy of the week, Trump. Would his business empire affect his presidency? Of all the reasons why Donald Trump shouldn't be president, said Kirk Eichenwald in Newsweek, perhaps the least discussed is that under a Trump administration, the foreign policy of the United States could well be for sale. A detailed investigation of the Trump Organization reveals that the Republican nominee runs a sprawling business empire that has spread a secretive financial web across the world, with deep ties to foreign financiers, politicians, and even criminals. Almost any foreign policy decision Trump might make as president would raise serious conflicts of interest. For example, Trump has a long-standing partnership with South Korea's Daewoo Engineering and Construction Corporation. If President Trump were to follow through on his bizarre suggestion to let South Korea develop nuclear weapons, Daewoo and Trump could make countless millions. And how will Trump's cozy, lucrative business relationship with investors and politicians in India affect the U.S.'s relationship with India's bitter rival, Pakistan? Trump still refuses to release his tax return, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon.com. But thanks to the Newsweek investigation, we now know he has business interests in China, Azerbaijan, the United Arab Emirates, and Brazil. The bottom line is this. Unless he completely shuts down the Trump Organization, he simply can't be president. Trump does not seem to understand or care about his mammoth conflicts of interest, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. He waves away concerns by saying he'll put the Trump Organization and all his investments into a blind trust run by his children, Ivanka, Eric, and Donald Jr. But no trust run by one's children can be blind. Trump would still be aware of how his decisions as president would affect his and his family's bottom line, which is a recipe for epic corruption on the scale of Vladimir Putin and Russia's oligarchs. No wonder he admires Putin. Why not let the voters decide how much this matters, said Mark Thiessen in WashingtonPost.com. Despite the media's attempt to bring him down, Trump is virtually tied with Hillary Clinton in the polls. And a new Quinnipiac University poll found that 54% of voters said Trump is transparent, compared with only 37% who think Hillary Clinton is. She's lied to the public time and time again about everything from Benghazi to her private email server. Trump's potential conflicts may be unusual, said Amanda Hoover in CSMonitor.com, but there is nothing illegal about them, as the U.S. criminal conflict of interest statute doesn't apply to the presidency. Besides, if he were caught using his power as president to boost his business ventures, he'd pay a stiff political price. Trump, though, has proven over and over again that he's utterly shameless, said Ryan Cooper in TheWeek.com. Everything we know about the man's character, ethics, and life story tells us that he would almost certainly attempt to leverage the power of the presidency to further enrich himself. Trump's scandals are so numerous and overwhelming that they've lost their power to shock, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Reports this week indicate that Trump illegally used his charity, the Trump Foundation, for business and personal expenses. Lawsuits against the fraudulent Trump University are underway in multiple states. There seems to be no area of his extremely complex financial life that is not infected by double dealing, public lies, broken promises, or outright fraud. If this swindler is allowed to get away with his giant shell game, then shame on all of us. It was a good week for kids who can't sit still. After a middle school math teacher in North Carolina installed bike pedals under desks to help students burn off excess energy and stop fidgeting. The kids loved them, said Bethany Lambeth. I've definitely noticed grades going up. It was a good week for proving the obvious after Swiss researchers conducted a study that revealed that drinking beer makes people more sociable and less sexually inhibited. Although many people drink beer and know its effects through personal experience, said the lead researcher Matthias Lichtai, there is surprisingly little scientific data. It was a good week for RoboCops after police in Los Angeles deployed a high-tech robot to sneak up on an armed suspect and snatch his gun in the midst of a standoff. He looked up and realized his gun was gone, said the police. The shocked suspect then surrendered. But it was a bad week for counting steps. After a study found that overweight dieters who wore activity tracking devices lost significantly less weight than those who dieted and exercised without a device. Researchers said daily readouts may provide a false sense of accomplishment. And it was a bad week for school spirit. After high school cheerleaders in Provo, Utah, were told not to wear their uniforms to class on practice day, because a male student complained that the short skirts were causing him to have impure thoughts. And it was a bad week for loving thy neighbor after a 90-year-old Florida man was arrested twice in a week for violating a local law by feeding homeless people. They were very gentle, said Arnold Abbott of the Fort Lauderdale Police. I think they feel a little guilty about doing their jobs. We're on the briefing page. The topic this week is the illegal immigrant population. Donald Trump has proposed deporting millions of Americans' illegal immigrants. Is that feasible? How many illegal immigrants are there? About 11 million, or 3.5% of the total U.S. population. The exact figure is obviously impossible to determine. The estimate essentially comes from taking the foreign-born population from census records, then subtracting the number of legal immigrants. Almost two-thirds of undocumented immigrants are believed to have been in the U.S. for more than 10 years. 60% are concentrated in six states: California, Texas, Florida, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois. They are more likely than native-born residents to be part of a nuclear family. 47% of illegal immigrant households are couples with at least one child, compared with 21% of non-immigrant households. But despite the scaremongering about foreigners pouring into the country, the undocumented immigrant population has in fact been steadily falling since 2007, when it peaked at 12 million. The decrease is largely because fewer Mexicans are crossing the border, thanks to improved border controls, the recession in the U.S., and rising employment and prosperity levels in Mexico. Are most illegal immigrants Mexican? About half of them are, 5.5 million. The others are mostly from various Central and South American countries. About 40% overstay their visa, while others cross the border illegally. But the latter ploy is becoming increasingly difficult. The federal government now spends more on immigration enforcement than it does on the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and the U.S. Marshals Service combined. The number of border agents quintupled between 1992 and 2010 to nearly 21,000. And 650 of the 1,954-mile border are now fenced. All of this has had a significant deterrent effect. There were only 188,000 Mexicans apprehended at the border last year, compared with 1.6 million in 2000. It's harder to sneak in, said Jeffrey Pussell in the Pew Hispanic Center. The cost of hiring a smuggler has gone up, and the enforcement practices have pushed a lot of people who were trying to sneak in into more remote areas. So it's more dangerous physically. How many illegal immigrants work? An estimated 8.1 million are either working or looking for work. Some are paid in cash, but many illegal immigrants use fake Social Security numbers and secure jobs and are thus U.S. taxpayers. Half of America's illegal immigrants are thought to pay income taxes in some form. In 2010, they contributed an estimated $10.6 billion in state and local taxes and $13 billion in Social Security. Contrary to common perception, illegal immigrants don't qualify for public benefits like welfare, food stamps, and Medicaid, as these programs require proof of legal immigration status. However, the children of undocumented immigrants do receive certain benefits in the form of public schooling and emergency medical care if they're born in the U.S. They qualify for welfare benefits, too. The Heritage Foundation has calculated that the average illegal immigrant household costs taxpayers $14,387 a year, though many economists have questioned the assumption used to reach that figure. What proportion are criminals? Based on Department of Homeland Security statistics, it's been estimated that about 820,000 illegal immigrants qualify as removable criminal aliens, or about 7.5% of all undocumented immigrants. Under President Obama, criminals have been the focus of the government's deportation strategy. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, ICE, deported 235,413 illegal immigrants in the last fiscal year. About 70% were removed after being caught within 100 miles of the border on the assumption they had recently crossed over. of the interior removals, those presumably living here for years, 91% have been convicted of crimes. If you are a run-of-the-mill immigrant here illegally, said John Sandweg, former acting director of ICE, your odds of getting deported are close to zero. Could all 11 million be deported? Not likely. Removing every illegal immigrant would cost an estimated $400 billion to $600 billion and deliver a $1 trillion hit to the economy because it would hurt industries that depend on their labor. Mass removal would also be unpopular. A recent Pew Research poll found that 76% of Americans say undocumented immigrants are as honest and hardworking as U.S. citizens. And a CNN poll found that 51% say Washington's priority should be finding a path to legalization for those already here. Just 11% say the focus should be on deporting all illegal immigrants. Generally, most congressional Republicans want the government to secure the border before the undocumented are given a path to legalization, while Democrats say additional border security is not necessary and that it's time to bring the 11 million out of the shadows. That difference in opinion has led to a two-decades-long stalemate in Washington that this November's election may finally resolve. Moving into the columns now, the first is from the U.S. Convictions based on junk science. Our legal system has convicted hundreds of thousands of people of crimes based on voodoo science, said Federal Appeals Court Judge Alex Kozinski. A new study from the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology has concluded that most forensic evidence techniques, including fingerprint, bite mark, firearm, footwear, and hair analysis techniques, have surprisingly high error rates and often are rank guesswork. Only the most basic form of DNA analysis is scientifically sound, the study found. This is stunning news, given that our courts heavily depend on the kind of forensic evidence glamorized by TV shows like CSI and Forensic Files. In reality, forensic experts often work for the prosecution and see their job as helping to secure a conviction. They usually tell juries that their risk error is vanishingly small or essentially zero, but that's simply not true. Bite mark analysis turns out to be totally unreliable. Fingerprint analysis can be wrong nearly 5% of the time. When several people's genetic material is found, even DNA analysis can be subjective and mistaken. The disturbing truth is that our justice system has sent countless numbers of people to jail and executed some of them based on junk science. From Ireland, Europe doesn't love us like America does. It's time to shift Ireland's focus away from Europe and toward America, said Billy Keane. What has the European Union ever done for us? It's bullied us into backing up its banks after the 2008 financial crisis, and now it is trying to destroy our one advantage, which is our low corporate tax base. We have benefited greatly from having Apple headquarter its European operations here, but now that the EU has ruled that Apple must pay us $14.5 billion in back taxes, whether we want it or not, the tech giant could up and leave our shores. Contrast this behavior with that of the U.S. All through the recession, the Americans were our only allies. Our booming tech industry exists because of our American friends. Irish Americans sincerely love us, and there are nearly eight times as many Irish Americans as Irish citizens. Even those with only one Irish grandparent or great-grandparent have a strong sense of connection to Ireland. President Obama, for example, speaks proudly of the Irish blood running through his daughter's veins, because even though his Irish ancestry goes back 8 generations, he feels Irish, and yes, he is Irish. It's nice to know that there will always be Irish in America who will fight for us and back us up. And this from Egypt. The evidence that ISIS is fake. What if ISIS is a creation of Western intelligence agencies, said Noha al-Shanoubi. It's pretty clear that 9/11 was an inside job, as it strains credulity that 4 hijacked planes flew around so freely, penetrated U.S. airspace and hit the World Trade Center and Pentagon one by one. Remember that the commanders of the attacks trained at the U.S. flight schools. The attacks were most likely planned in advance by the Americans to justify the war on terror and invasion of Muslim lands. Now that we are seeing the next phase with the rise of the supposed Islamic terrorist group ISIS, why is it that most ISIS members that we see on propaganda videos are not Arabs, but foreigners? ISIS may be just another story concocted to justify the partitioning and occupation of the Middle East. It's quite likely that Western intelligence operatives were behind the bombings and mass shootings that have taken place in European cities like Paris and Brussels, and that innocent Muslims were then framed for the attacks and killed for the arrested. We've already heard rhetoric from Western politicians like America's Donald Trump and France's Marie Le Pen that Muslims should be persecuted and expelled. When it finally happens, the fake threat from ISIS will be the excuse. And we'll move to our in-depth article, The Last Word. Learning chess at 40. When my 4-year-old daughter expressed an interest in chess, I decided to learn along with her, said writer Tom Vanderbilt. It turned out my age wasn't an advantage. My 4-year-old daughter and I were deep in a game of checkers one day about 3 years ago when her eye drifted to a nearby table. There, a black and white board bristled with far more interesting figures like horses and castles. "What's that?" she asked. "Chess," I replied. "Can we play?" she asked. I nodded absently. There was just one problem. I didn't know how. I dimly remembered having learned the basic moves in elementary school, but it never stuck. This fact vaguely haunted me through my life. Idle chessboards in hotel lobbies or puzzles in weekend paper supplements teased me like reproachful riddles. And so I decided I would learn, if only so I could teach my daughter. The basic moves were easy enough to pick up. A few hours hunched over my smartphone at kids' birthday parties or waiting in line at the grocery store. It soon became apparent, however, that I had no concept of the larger strategy. The chess literature was dauntingly huge and achingly specific, with several 100-page tomes devoted to unpacking single openings. So, time-starved and not wanting to curse my daughter with my ill-formed knowledge, I hired a coach to teach us both. We soon sat down to weekly sessions with Simon Radowski, a Brooklyn-based Polish immigré whose old-world formality and hint of sternness lent what I thought was an appropriate gravity to the task. It wasn't long before it struck me that chess seemed to be a game for the young. When my daughter began doing scholastic tournaments, I would chat up other parents and ask whether they played. Usually the reply was an apologetic shrug and a smile. I would explain that I, too, was learning to play, and the resulting tone was cheerily patronizing. "Good luck with that." Reading about an international tournament, I was struck by a suggestion that a grandmaster had passed his peak. He was in his 30s. We are used to athletes being talked about in this way, but a mind game like chess? Although it scarcely occurred to me at the time, my daughter and I were embarking on a sort of cognitive experiment. We were two novices attempting to learn a new skill, essentially beginning from the same point but separated by some four decades of life. I had been the expert to that point in her life, in knowing what words meant or how to ride a bike, but now we were on a curiously equal footing. Or so I thought. I began to regularly play online, do puzzles, and even leafed through books like Bent Larson's Best Games. I seemed to be doing better with the game, if only because I was more serious about it. When we played, she would sometimes flag in her concentration, and to keep her spirits up, I would commit disastrous blunders. In the context of the larger chess world, I was a patzer, a hopelessly bumbling novice, but around my house, at least, I felt like a benevolently sage elder statesman. And then my daughter began beating me. The age question is hoary in chess. Indeed, one of the earliest discussions of the now universal player ranking system called the ELO rating, named for its inventor, Arpad Elo, was in a 1965 article in the Journal of Gerontology. Using his novel statistical analysis, Elo found that the peak age for master-level chess performance was around 36, with a slow, steady decline after that. That was then. Today, chess is only getting younger. Neil Charnas, a professor of psychology at Florida State University, has long studied the question of chess and performance. Bobby Fischer became a grandmaster at age 15, he says. Then Judith Polgar beat his record. And then Sergei Karjakin beat Polgar by doing it in 2002 at age 12. The record of the youngest age to achieve grandmaster status, Charnas tells me, keeps getting beat. Magnus Carlsen, the world's current top-ranked player, was the youngest player to reach number one at age 19. Charnas notes that the younger players are getting skilled faster than they used to, thanks in part to better tools and better feedback. Sophisticated computer engines, databases, and the ability to play players of any level at any time of the day. Chess, which has been dubbed the fruit fly of cognitive psychology, seems a tool that is purpose-built to show the deficits of an aging brain. The psychologist Timothy Salthouse has noted that cognitive tests on speed, reasoning, and memory show age-related declines that are fairly large, linear, and most alarming to me, clearly apparent before age 50. And there are clear consequences on the chessboard. In one study, Charnas had players of a variety of skills try to assess when a check was threatened in a match. The more skilled the player, the quicker they were able to do this, as if it were a perceptual judgment, essentially by pattern recognition stored up front from previous matches. But no matter what the skill level, the older a player was, the slower they were to spot the threat of a check. It's not just that age slows you. You need to begin young, too. Charnas points to research by Nikolai Krogius, a Russian grandmaster and psychologist, that shows a positive correlation between the age at which one first learns the game and later success in tournaments. This idea now seems so ingrained that Carlsen is held as a fascinating outlier. At 5 years old, one account marvels, an age by which any aspiring grandmaster should have at least have made a start, Magnus Carlsen showed little interest in chess. Starting later, Charnas tells me, seemed to be a handicap. As we get older, there is one thing at which we get worse, being a novice. Charnas, in one study, had subjects of various ages learn a novel word processing application. Some were experienced with similar programs. Others were novices. The older the novice, the longer it took them to learn. If you're talking about two novices, Jarnas said when I asked him about my daughter, me, and chess, your daughter would probably pick things up about twice as fast as you could. My daughter is, in effect, learning chess like a first language, where I am learning it like a second language. Her brain, like a chessboard at the beginning of a game, is still full of infinite possibility, bristling with countless synapses that have yet to be pruned. As the neuroscientist Peter Huttenlocher noted in Brain Research, a seven-year-old, like my daughter is today, has a brain that is almost fully formed but has a synaptic density some 36% higher than the adult mean. She is, in a sense, still making sense of the world, and as she does, those synapses are closed, like emptying one's hard drive of little-used applications in order to help optimize overall performance. What was happening in my brain as chessboard, by contrast, seemed more like a cagey defensive middle game battle in which I was trying to hold on to pieces in the face of a closing denouement. Denise Park, the director of research at the University of Texas Center for Vital Longevity, described what was happening to me in unsettling terms. As you get older, you actually see clear degradation of the brain, even in healthy people. Your frontal cortex gets smaller. Your hippocampus, the seat of the memory, shrinks. My brain volume is atrophying annually, my cortical thickness dropping some 0.5% a year. It was my daughter's sense of effortlessness that got to me. Where I would carefully ponder the board, she would sweep it with lightning moves. Where I would carefully stick to the scripts I had been taught, a night on the rim is dim, she seemed to be making things up. After what seemed a particularly disastrous move, I would try to play coach for a moment and ask, "Are you sure that's what you want to do?" She would shrug. I would feel a momentary shiver of pity and frustration. "It's not sticking," I would think. And then she would deliver some punishing pin on the queen, or a deft back rank attack I had somehow overlooked. I would sometimes wander into the room when Coach Simon was there, watching him present her with some puzzle on the board. I would struggle toward some solution, feeling smug, only to find I had completely botched it. My daughter, meanwhile, swiftly moved the right piece into position. He would shoot me a look, beaming at her precociousness. I was proud. I was frustrated. There are surely fewer greater parental satisfactions than to see one's progeny doing well at something. But there is an altogether different feeling, a sobering slap of pathos, a vague sense of alarm that some genie has been let out of the bottle when they exceed you on the same task. When a person who still cannot always successfully tie her own shoes, who has yet to do long division, can beat me at the royal game. She was deep blue, and I was the human race, being slowly outmoded. I resisted the idea that I was just too old. I was stubbornly proud, competitive, but also curious. Was it just age, or was my daughter an inherently better player? I returned to the experts for reassurance. Park told me I was most likely at the peak of my cognitive power. For all my daughter's seemingly sprightly processing power, I had higher order capacities I could draw upon. "If you're younger, you can process information super fast," she told me, "but you may not know what to do with that information as you process it." There are, I learned, two forms of intelligence, fluid and crystallized. Fluid intelligence is, basically, being able to think on one's feet, to solve new problems. Crystallized intelligence is what a person already knows, wisdom, memories, metacognition. Even if I was only learning chess for the first time, I had a lifetime of play behind me. Fluid intelligence is generally seen to favor the young, with the crystallized variety rewarded by age, though there are many exceptions. Old mathematicians doing their best work are as rare as young Supreme Court justices. Chess, especially at the top levels, can encompass both fluid and crystallized intelligence. One needs the firepower to quickly think through a novel position, but it also helps to draw upon a deep reservoir of past games. Grandmasters like Carlsen can often identify a historical game with a glimpse at a single position. Of course, my daughter, like most children her age, has not memorized a huge library of games, nor does she consciously think in terms of higher-level strategy. She seems to play with some brute instinct, pure fluid intelligence. As Daniel King, a London-based retired professional chess player, who now analyzes and commentates chess matches, tells me, children just kind of go for it. That kind of confidence can be very disconcerting for the opponent. When I asked Coach Simon about the differences he sees in trying to teach beginner children and beginner adults, he said, adults need to explain to themselves why they play what they play. Kids don't do that. It's like with languages. Beginner adults learn the rules of grammar and pronunciation and use those to put sentences together. Little kids learn languages by talking. Here was my opening. I would counter her fluidity with my storehouses of crystallized intelligence. I was probably never going to be as speedily instinctual as she was, but I could, I thought, go deeper. I could get strategic. I began to watch Daniel King's analysis of top-level matches on YouTube. I could simply put in more effort. The house took on a war room atmosphere. Then, months into her winning streak, I beat my daughter at chess twice in a row, even if I had to work twice as hard to do it. I learned that as good as my daughter is at launching aggressive attacks, at almost clinically probing my weaknesses, she has a blind spot, what I am doing. She played in those games as if I were just some lower-level chess engine making haplessly random moves. Indeed, when I made my moves, her eyes would often drift elsewhere, as if what I was doing was almost inconsequential to the larger game. She failed to spot that my seemingly minor, unthreatening moves were all part of a larger strategic purpose. Against her onrushing fluidity, I was laying in a minefield of crystallized traps. It was, in the end, a Pyrrhic victory. Not only has she since beaten me many times, but there was the look in her eyes as I checkmated her a second time. For whatever the games had taught me about brains, young and old, about the different ways we learn and deploy our cognitive resources, they also taught me that the only thing harder than losing to your daughter in chess is winning against her. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in nautil.us, nautil.us. On the health and science page, how the moon can cause major earthquakes. The tug of the moon's gravity on Earth is strong enough to generate the daily ebb and flow of tides around the world. New research suggests the moon also has influence on the planet's crust and can trigger massive earthquakes along fragile fault lines. The effects of lunar gravity are most dramatic during full and new moons when Earth, the Sun, and the Moon are aligned. After analyzing more than 10,000 earthquakes, geologists at the University of Tokyo found that megaquakes of magnitude 8 or above were more likely to occur during full or new moons. They note that the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and the 2010 Chilean earthquake, which unleashed devastating tsunamis, both hit during high tide periods. The Earth's surface is made up of tectonic plates, which create enormous pressure as they constantly move and grind against one another. Quakes occur when the plates suddenly move at fault lines or fractures, releasing pent-up energy. The researchers contend the extra stress from strong tidal forces can push already strained faults beyond their tipping point. The tides just add a little, 1% or less, additional push on top of that tectonic loading, U.S. Geological Survey geophysicist Nicholas van der Elts tells the Los Angeles Times. Even though it's a small contribution, it could be just the amount of stress that is the straw that breaks the camel's back. Big Sugar conspired to conceal health risks. For decades, the sugar industry paid off researchers to downplay the health effects of sweets and pin the blame for increased heart disease risk on saturated fat and cholesterol, a new study reveals. Combing over documents that date back half a century, a University of California San Francisco researcher discovered that a trade group called the Sugar Research Foundation commissioned a 1967 Harvard review to discredit emerging claims about the harmful effects of sugar. Industry executives dictated what research would be included in the review and then controlled its findings, which were published in the New England Journal of Medicine, reports the New York Times. Ultimately, the review criticized studies linking sugar and heart disease and emphasized the harmful effects of unhealthy fats. In return, the Harvard researchers were paid the modern equivalent of about $50,000, a conflict of interest that was never disclosed publicly. For the next 50 years, millions of Americans opted for low-fat, sugary foods now associated with obesity and heart disease. They were able to derail the discussion about sugar for decades, says study author Stanton Glantz. But today's standards, they behaved very badly. On the Talking Points page, Snowden, the case for and against a pardon. Should President Obama pardon Edward Snowden, asked Kaval Waddell in TheAtlantic.com. As Oliver Stone releases a film that portrays Snowden as a hero, human rights groups are mounting a campaign to get a reprieve for the former government computer expert. In 2013, Snowden fled to Russia to avoid espionage charges after leaking classified documents that exposed the National Security Agency's massive digital spying program in the U.S. and abroad. Obama, who once promised to run the most transparent White House in history, was clearly stung by Snowden's revelations and has said he doesn't consider him a whistleblower. Even if Obama changed his mind, pardoning Snowden would feed the conservative narrative that the president is weak and an apologist for America and hurt Hillary Clinton's chances in November. Snowden's only hope is that after the election, Obama will decide to make a conciliatory gesture to compensate for his national security overreaches. There is no question that Obama should pardon Snowden, said Michael Shank in USAtoday.com. Snowden exposed the NSA's egregious collecting of Americans' telephone metadata, who calls whom and when, without case-by-case court approval. Though intelligence officials told Congress that Snowden compromised sensitive military operations and techniques, the truth is that Snowden didn't give away much our adversaries didn't already know. The administration wants to prosecute Snowden under the antiquated Espionage Act of 1917, said Kenneth Roth and Sahil Shetty in the New York Times. But a lot has changed since World War I. Snowden's actions have brought about a dramatic increase in our awareness of the risks to our privacy in the digital age. That shouldn't get you locked up or exiled for a lifetime. Snowden does deserve credit for exposing the NSA's metadata program, which prompted Congress to end bulk collection of telephone records, said the Washington Post in an editorial. But Snowden also pilfered and leaked information about PRISM, a legal overseas internet monitoring program, and exposed details of U.S. cyber operations against China and a joint U.S.-Scandinavian effort to gather information about Russia's spying programs. No specific harm came to Americans from the metadata program, but Snowden's revelations about NASA's international operations, about NSA's international operations, potentially damaged national security. Ideally, Snowden would come home and hash out all of this before a jury of his peers. Doing some jail time to uphold his beliefs would certainly be in the best tradition of civil disobedience. And a few short notes. An analysis of the House Speaker Paul Ryan's tax plan by the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center found that by 2025, 99.6% of the tax cuts would benefit the wealthiest 1% of Americans. About 130 million of the 265 million guns owned by Americans are concentrated in the hands of just 3% of adults, according to the most definitive portrait of U.S. gun ownership in two decades. The Harvard Northeastern survey found that these gun super enthusiasts have amassed an average of 17 firearms each. Overall, only 22% of the population own a gun. The poll watch, 82% of American voters have made up their minds about which presidential candidate they are voting for, while 18% say they might switch. Only 57% of independents have made up their mind. And a quote for the day from cartoonist Bill Watterson. Life's disappointments are harder to take if you don't know any swear words. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.